Welcome to the Retzel Health Law Hotspot. Health Law Hotspot is a podcast for physicians and health professionals that covers the legal issues and trends that affect the healthcare industry.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Health Law Hotspot. I'm Erica Adler, shareholder and practice group leader of our health law practice at Retzel & Andrus. Today, I'm joined by Andrea Winslow. Andrea has been in the staffing and recruiting industry for 23 years, and for the past 12 years, she's been specializing exclusively in neurosurgery recruitment. She has authored and co-authored articles specific to neurosurgery recruitment and has personally assisted over 100 academic programs and community practices with their recruitment efforts throughout her career. We're really excited to have you with us today. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much. This is so exciting. I'm glad to be with you.
So today we're going to be talking about a really interesting topic, which is recruitment, obviously. And from both sides, really, we're going to be talking about it. From the employer side, how do you recruit those great candidates? What is the information you should be putting out there? What are the things to avoid so you don't scare away candidates or make yourself less appealing? What are some of maybe the things that you should be thinking about that you're not? And then on the other side, for those candidates out there, how do you find that job? What are some of the red flags that you don't want to miss when you're looking for the job as well, which I know a lot of my doctors, by the time I get to talking with them, and you know, it's too late and they haven't asked the right question. So hopefully this will be really helpful to everyone watching. And so why don't we start off with you just telling us a little bit, maybe on the employer side of things, of how you go about working with your employers when they tell you, hey, we really need to find someone.
Sure. I do work with academic programs and with private practices and hospitals alike, and there are different questions to ask depending on which practice or program calls us and asks us for help. We have a pretty lengthy vetting process that we go through prior to accepting the opportunity in order to help find them candidates. So some of the things that we ask are related to, first and foremost, why they're recruiting. We want to know if someone retired or if they're expanding, what is happening, that they need a new physician. We go through all kinds of questions related to, depending on the specialty, whether there's a subspecialty need, what that volume looks like. Of course, what the number of surgeries or number of referrals that the person can expect to receive, the new hire. We talk about call, how often it is, whether they get paid for call. We talk about really how the practice is run. Is there an administrator who is really responsible for the operations side, or are you going to be responsible for that? Academically, what kind of research resources are available, and of course, the all important compensation, how that is structured, what the range is, all of those sorts of things are questions we ask prior to taking an opportunity on.
Well, what kinds of things might you be told that would turn you away from taking on an opportunity? I mean, that seems kind of crazy that you would say, no, we don't want to help you find someone. Well, yeah. What kind of things would those be?
Let's see. Anecdotally, I can tell you last week I had a CEO called me. He is a CEO of a new hospital. He wanted to recruit a couple of physicians. I already knew that in the community, there were a set of private practice physicians primarily admitting to that hospital. And so I asked whether the CEO was going to, whether he was going to provide the physicians into that practice, help support them recruit, or work to compete. And he didn't care either way how we recruited. And so from my perspective, kind of knowing the community and the environment there, knew that the current physicians that were primarily admitting to that hospital would have for sure blocked anybody from coming in. because they wouldn't help them with call. That's how they're going to block them. And ask the CEO politely to sort of figure out whether he's truly willing to help the practice, because I don't want to set someone up to fail to try to come in, even if they hired two at the same time to compete with a longstanding practice can be quite difficult. If the call really onerous and they're not paying as much as they should, if they're not being supported with a proper trauma team, if there's a lot of times it's a level one trauma center and there aren't residents to help, most practices will look for nurse practitioners or PAs to take first call, or to have a really great trauma team with hospitalists admitting patients. Sometimes none of that is in place. If they're telling me that the compensation is really, really low, obviously I'm not going to be able to get them across the finish line, and I don't want to wait to find that out when we get to the altar, only to be left. There could be very, very little volume. All sorts of things happen that we wouldn't be willing to take the recruitment on.
Do you find that you generally get the truth when you're kind of vetting these employees? A lot of times I find that when I get a contract and I look at it and start talking about it with my doctors, I'll tell them what's in there and they'll say, well, that's not what the recruiter told me, or that's not, you know, what the job was supposed to be. How often do things like that really happen?
Not very often, but often enough that you should be paying attention. Your questions are quite poignant, because I have another situation that happened this week. It's not a opportunity that I'm representing, but oftentimes when I'm speaking with candidates seeking positions, they will run with me through other offers they've received. I'm, you know, here as a resource to help them get to the best place possible. That's just, I'm led by my ethics that way. So they shared with me what the offer was, which was very different than what they were told verbally. Very different, meaning the RVU number was half of what they were told. The threshold was higher. It was categorically different in every single step of the offer process. So I know that that happens. I had since then had to coach them on how to go back to them and ask about these sorts of things, which they're in the middle of doing. But clearly that's a flag for them, meaning him and his wife. So they likely won't be joining that practice. But it does happen from time to time. Most times they're pretty straightforward, because most times in my experience, the hospitals don't really truly see it's an issue, right? To be able to not be straightforward with it. So they just explain the opportunity as it is. And then, you know, we have to vet them and let them know that they're not likely going to be successful.
Right. And I know, depending on the specialty, different things are really important when you're looking at a particular offer. So, you know, in your specialty, one of the big issues obviously is call and compensation, I would say. So, you know, generally in neurosurgery, physicians are pretty highly compensated, but they also take a ton of call. And it's really kind of a lifestyle thing. Other specialties, there's no way, you know, they would want to take that amount of call or would expect to. So I would assume that if, you know, in those specialties, there's other specialties where there's a lot of call as well. You know, when you're the one putting the job offer out there, I assume that one of the first things they're asking about is, what is the call commitment at this site? And what am I paid for it? And then tied to that is, am I paid if I take more for call as well? And I think you and I may have talked about this, but a lot of times my doctors are like, you know, it's not really always about the money. I don't want to be forced to take more call. It's just, it's enough. So Right. Can you kind of speak to call and compensation, other things that you think are really kind of the key things that people are asking? You know, maybe they don't care so much about the size of the hospital or, you know, the community at large, but other more important things.
Sure. I think that, right, call is a very important component for many specialties. The level of acuity within the hospital, but also just the availability I hear often that we're a level three trauma center. So being on 1 and 2 call isn't that big of a deal. It's highly consultative in nature. The fact is they have to be available every other day for call, which is quite a commitment that a lot of people aren't interested to participate in. So it's not just about the compensation, to your point. It's also about the lifestyle. It's about the, you know, the how onerous the call is, whether it impacts their ability to have an elective practice, right? So the call can get so onerous that they that's all they're doing is taking care of what's coming through the ER instead of holding clinic and having the ability to operate on those elective cases. So that's an issue. The other issue would be the number of days. Oftentimes hospitals have really, especially in the last 10 years, I think, have, because we've moved, this is such a trend toward hospital employment during that time, private practice is dwindling. It's not gone, and there are some terrific private practices out there that are operationally savvy. But there's no doubt that there is a trend toward hospital employment, and hospitals have since then baked or had their a certain number of days of call as part of their base salary. Lots of physicians aren't very happy with that. I think it's probably something that's here to stay. But as long as it's reasonable and the base salary compensation covers that, I think it's fine. The other issue that I see on the candidate side, although we're talking about employers, but I think it's important to talk about when we're speaking about call, is that when a new physician starts, they are very eager oftentimes to build a busy practice fast. And one way to do that is to take more call than is required, right? So they want to show the hospital they're very eager, their partners are very eager, they want to show they have a good work ethic. What happens is, however, is they wind up getting burnout, or, and so they want to scale it back at that point. But then the hospital is so used to them doing that, that it then becomes the expectation. Right. So it's kind of, you teach people how to treat you. And if you are so gung ho, you really have to set that expectation up front that you're going to, for yourself and for the hospital, that perhaps you'll do this for 6 months or 3 months or a year or what have you. So they know that this is not a long term circumstance. So you don't have false expectations out there.
Right. I think that's a great point. I mean, a lot of times my doctors will say that to me as well. And I'll say, look, I said, it's one thing if you want to do it voluntarily, but it's another if the contract can require it. And so I usually try and set a maximum amount of required call when I can, because I know down the road, they're going to feel differently about it. And I think that is a really important issue. In terms of lifestyle, since you mentioned it, I know money is important, but there are a couple of other things that my doctor tend to be really interested in. It may not apply quite as much with the neurosurgeons, but the lifestyle comes down to really schedule and call and location and the ability not to be told they have to work when they weren't expecting to work or go somewhere they weren't expecting to go. So yeah. I like to try and lock in, like, this is where your primary site is and we'll agree on other sites, or your schedule is going to be kind of the standard a weekday schedule unless we otherwise agree, so that if, you know, there's a shift where suddenly they want to start doing weekend clinics or evening clinics, my docs can't be forced to do that. And, you know, doctors with young families, et cetera, that can be, you know, really unexpected and unpleasant change, right? So is that the kind of detail you'll get into in a recruitment? Because most hospitals say, we treat everybody the same. We're not making that change to the contract. And it can become a real issue of tension.
Right, right. I see not really weekend or changing that on my side, but what I do see about lifestyle is that they'll tack on extra clinics in outlying areas that they weren't going to, or it wasn't explained to them up front that this would be a part of their job. Right. So they think their clinic is just at the hospital, and then they find out they're going 2-3 hours away, and they keep adding more and more, especially systems, adding more and more hospitals. And so the flagship hospital will send their surgeons or physicians out to all these other hospitals, number one, to cover call, but also to hold clinic. And before you know it, it becomes, I had one surgeon tell me last week, he was asked to go to a place 100 miles away that he wasn't going to in his first year of practice. Well, he doesn't, I mean, by the time you have, and then you're expecting people you don't know and don't have a relationship with, and the hospital isn't set up to round on those patients post-operatively.
Yeah, I definitely
becomes a malpractice issue.
Right, mm-hmm. Absolutely. And, and so not only that, but whenever you're commuting, you're also not working, generating WUs, generating productivity. So it's not just a matter of being uncooperative. It's a matter of it affects your numbers also. So I always try and get mutual agreement on locations, et cetera. That's often a big deal as well. So if we were to kind of, let's look at the other side of this for a second. So if you're the doctor who's looking, we kind of have been talking about this a little bit. You know, when they're looking at a recruitment offer, are there things that they, you know, maybe are a little unusual or maybe might be something they want to pay particular attention to? I mean, they see the compensation formula, they see, you know, the need for the hire, et cetera. Are there any like red flags that they should say, well, I'm walking away from this offer? Anything like that that you could think of?
Certainly related to compensation. I think that, you know, getting an offer, there's a psychological component to that. So I would think two things. So one, someone will look at a base salary, and if they feel that it's low, would summarily dismiss the offer altogether when there are so many more components. I say that offers are like snowflakes, almost no single one is the same, just from system to system, practice to practice, et cetera. So I think it's, first of all, important to look at the offer holistically. If it's a low base, it might be a low RVU threshold. If it's a low base from a private practice, it's probably an offer that's coming straight out of the physician's pockets and not the hospital. And so, you know, the hospitals have deeper pockets. I think that getting an offer from a private practice, and when they're, while it might be and is oftentimes lower than what a hospital can offer, this, the physicians in that practice have a vested interest to see you succeed, right? That's the good part about them ponying up their own money to bring you forward. And then it's the other components. If it's a low base, it, as I said, it might be a low RVU threshold and a high dollar per RVU amount. So I would encourage people to keep an open mind and to consider seeing all points of the offer. That said, if it's a low base and the hospital or the hiring authority says, well, you get paid a lot in call, you really, you're probably not going to be building an elective practice, and you're only going to be able to make a living by taking a ton of call. That's not a good feeling. It won't work long term, likely. Other things in the offer would be just simple things like relocation. If we're talking about flags, I'm kind of dipping into some other pieces on the employment, on the candidate side now, but I'm never a fan personally of the candidate paying for any part of the process. If they're making you fly out on your own dime to see a practice, that's a flag for me. Certain things like that, I think, are important to watch out for.
I think so too. And then, you know, there's also some flags when the offer makes its way over to me to take a look at, which I don't think sometimes necessarily come up in the recruitment process. That would be the non-compete, for example, which can make an otherwise great sounding offer suddenly completely objectionable. Right? I mean, 100-mile radius and a great offer, but now 100-mile radius and you're for 2 years or something and your family's from nearby and you hope to at least be able to, you know, go work somewhere else in the area, and suddenly it's not a great offer anymore. That's one issue that I see. And unfortunately, it's not, you know, whether it's legal or not is not always the question, but sometimes, you know, some of these organizations stand really you know, firmly on their position, and they're like, take it or leave it, right?
Right.
So a lot of times you can lose an opportunity just because of that non-compete.
Yeah, I think that's a big one. I think non-compete is huge. I also think the out clause, meaning, you know, how much notice do you have to give if you decide to leave? And how much notice do they have to provide to you if they want you to leave? And under what circumstances is it, you know, for cause or without cause? A lot of those contracts, when they come over from the hospitals, I'm sure you see that and you get to them, it's,
right,
you know, not spelled out the way that it should be. 180 days notice. I saw 365 days notice once.
Right. I see a wide range. You're right. I say 90 days is still kind of the average. The one thing I see in those termination provisions, which has really become super popular in this past year, year and a half, I don't know, maybe 2 years even, is the right of the employer to suddenly, even if proper notice has been given by the doctor, to suddenly accelerate the termination date to any day they choose. So a doctor decides he wants to leave, he makes plans to go to another job, starts getting credentialed, gives his appropriate notice, and there's a provision there that says they can accelerate. So they say, great, thank you for your notice. Friday is your last day, right? And even the doctor did everything right, and yet he or she is now done, has no compensation until they can start working again. And it's actual acceleration of the termination date, which is different than saying, you know, we don't want you to work during the notice period, but we'll continue to pay you, which is still what the majority of contracts say. This is an acceleration of the termination date, which is grossly unfair. I really struggle with that. And to me, I will tell somebody, if you don't get this change, don't sign this contract. Have you seen that at all?
Yes. And what we really encourage is to make sure that you are providing notice in the amount of days that you should, but that you are letting the future practice know that you're waiting this amount of time in case something like that happens,
right,
so that the time that you're off and start is compressed. So a lot of times they'll wait until their license in the new state comes through before they'll let their soon-to-be former employer know. That's what we encourage them to do, is to really hold off in case something like that happens.
Right. And I think, you know, in terms of making your offer to a candidate look appealing, you know, the non-compete and the termination provision, you know, that can make or break a potential candidate's interest, right? Another one would be the malpractice. And I think, you know, if you're the hospital, a lot of hospitals will, you know, just have an occurrence policy or cover it. But if you're a smaller hospital or a practice, that is a big deal issue as well, because then there's a little tension over who's going to pay for that
tail
when the relationship ends. And I see some hospitals now, even if they have a occurrence policy, kind of coming up with an equivalent tail or, you know, cost to charge the doctor when the doctor goes to leave. Are you ever talking with your institutions or groups that are recruiting about that issue, which is kind of, you know, monetary in nature?
Sure. So we do on occasion where they'll have to pay for tail. What I often suggest is that the new employer, if their carrier will assume prior acts, it's usually for a period of 2 years. The premium is a little higher, but it's less expensive than a tail. And most, in my experience, most of the new employers are willing to do that.
Yeah, I haven't seen it being accepted quite maybe as often as you have. Definitely not. I see hospitals helping to pay the cost of the tail, maybe give a bonus to help with that. And certainly for practices, you know, very often they're not willing to do that as well. So we get kind of into like an argument over who's going to pay that tail. And we try and work it out by saying, oh, well, if termination is for these reasons, you pay for it. If it's for that reason, you know, the other side pays, and then kind of breaking down. I wish, and I think part of the thing is that you tend to deal with really highly compensated neurosurgeons where, you know, you've got those institutions kind of covering it. But, you know, for a lot of other specialties, sometimes the hospital is not even covering the malpractice.
It's on
the
market. That makes sense.
Yeah. Right. And, you know, so what could sound like a really lucrative deal, the idea that when you go to leave, even if it's just because you're not happy and it wasn't a good fit, you have to come up with $50,000,
$75,000. Right.
It's huge. It's a big financial piece of it.
Agree.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I guess it just maybe is very specialty dependent as well. For smaller groups that are looking to hire, so non-hospitals, you know, what are some of the mistakes that you see them making? Is it, you know, I'll say that some of the things I see is they don't share enough information. So they try and, you know, be too subtle and then people feel misled. But have you seen that? What do you see private groups doing that is a mistake?
Private groups, most often in my experience, by the time they come to me, because they often try to recruit on their own, right? And so when I get to them, they've already tried, or they were successful and hired and had a bad hire. And so they feel they need an expert. And so by the time I get to them, they're doing two things, I think. Number one, they're not vetting the candidate properly. You know, this is, it's like a marriage. It really is. You have to, and so they're dazzled by maybe the personality of the candidate and not really what their skills are. Are they conducting proper references?
Right.
They don't do that a lot of times.
Like you like someone, so that's enough.
It can be like one of the reps, right? So in my world, reps are a big deal. They know they're operating, you know, with the physician. And so they'll get somebody, a rep friend knows a rep friend who knows this guy that, you know, so that's how it happens sometimes. And they really aren't interested or don't have the time or both to vet them properly. And they really do need to take the time. Recruitment is a part-time job on top of their full-time job, right? Nobody really wants to take the time to recruit, but in order to do it right, you have to invest. And so those, you know, they start to cut corners there a little bit. I think the other piece to your point is that practices should be, we use the term opening their books, right? To show exactly what their financials look like. And a lot of practices are so hesitant to do that. But the physician isn't willing, a savvy physician isn't willing to take the job if they don't see what their potential will be based off of the others that are currently in the practice.
Right.
So if you're not willing to do that, to me, it's a non-starter.
I agree. I mean, sometimes they can be kind of cagey. They view that information as confidential. I guess it just depends how many candidates there are. So if you have several good candidates and only one wants to see your books, you might not go with that one, right? Because they're asking too much information. I see the same thing very often with future partnership offers, right? So a lot of times, you know, people want to know some information, you know, by when are you going to tell me one way or the other? Would I be an equal partner? You know, what did people pay to become partners in the past? And I, you know, I think even just answering those general questions about saying, you know, this is the exact formula. This is, you know, you don't have to always give everything to be able to give something. And I think, you know, sometimes doctors, they feel, you know, are these the people that I want to spend my career with? If they won't even tell me enough to let me know that I'll be okay, you know, I'm moving my family here or whatever it is. So I think when I kind of mentioned maybe not sharing as much information as they could, you know, that's what I mean as well.
Yeah. Partnership track is huge. You know, it's interesting. I have, you're hitting a lot of key points that I've discussed in, very recently with physicians. And so that was another one where there was a group, all three solo private practice providers that decided to get together and form one group and then recruit. Well, they didn't have to discuss a partnership track, right? Until they started to recruit, they didn't even know what that should look like. How many years does it take in practice with that practice in order to make partner? What are the benefits of becoming partner, right? You just don't want to share overhead. That's no fun. There should be some monetary value to that. Are they participating in ancillary opportunities for income. What does that look like? What are the returns on that? Should they be willing to participate? Do you get an equal say in how the practice is run once you make partner? There are other, I think, write-offs that you can have, writing off your office supplies and your car if you're traveling to clinic, and your phone and things of that nature. A key partnership track, one of the tips that they do, one practice does, is in order for you to keep your partnership status, you need to take call. Otherwise, you have the older guys who aren't taking call. They stay on as partner, but the younger guys are getting dumped on, right? So in order to avoid that, the call piece is a requirement of the partnership track. Right. Most practices, in my experience, don't necessarily write it down. You know, they'll go through it because it's subjective in nature. You have to be a good citizen. You have to be a team player. So those are more subjective, but it's important to ask those questions for sure.
Right. And I definitely, you know, being on the employer side very often, you know, the fact is that that language is always going to be discretionary. Nobody wants to have to sell to someone they don't think is a great doctor yet. Maybe it's a timing issue, or that they just, it's not a great fit. So we're always going to see that as being discretionary. And I think that's appropriate. And I often tell my doctors, like, look, this is kind of standard. You don't know if you like them, and they don't know if they like you. So they're not going to give you a promise to make you a partner one day. But I do think that a time frame is really important. You know, after certain, you don't want to wait forever. After a certain point, if they're not going to make you a partner, then you can make a decision about your future, you know? So I think that's important. I think these are all really key things. I mean, we could talk forever about some of those things, you're right. But I think, you know, these are all things that both doctors need to think about when they're joining, and employers need to think about when they're looking to hire, because they may not be thinking about what the turn-ons and turn-offs are of the other side, and making that kind of like a fatal mistake, right? Hiring the wrong person because they didn't do their diligence, or not keeping their word when they told them what it was going to be like to work there, or, you know, not sharing enough information about the things that were important that every young doctor or not so young doctor, whatever it is, wants to know. You know what I mean? For female physicians, I often find it really hard to get information about maternity leave. Sometimes they won't share information about how a formula will be impacted when someone's out on a maternity leave. And then, you know, if you're out for a gross period of time and the formula is annualized, what adjustments are they making? You know, so those kind of questions, my female doctors will often just kind of get unsatisfactory responses. Or, you know, if they do get a response, they'll realize that that formula sounds great, but it's not for them if they want to have a family. You know, it's not built for somebody to take a long absence like that. So, do you come across that at all?
Right. So we're actually preparing for a talk right now with an organization in neurosurgery called Women in Neurosurgery, WINS. And we're going to talk about the female perspective in neurosurgery, which is largely a male-dominated specialty, right? I don't know exactly. I want to say maybe 20%, maybe are female. So it's important. What we see are, private practices in particular shy away, honestly, a lot of times to recruit women. Their mindset is not that they think that they're sexist, but that it's when they are of childbearing age and family planning, and they go out on maternity leave or out for part of their pregnancy, and, you know, and then thereafter have a family and want to pay attention to them, that takes away from their ability to build their elective practice. It's an imbalance from a call perspective while they're out. Things of that nature are what they're thinking, right? So, I have heard that, I'll say, in my career. I think that compensation, at least in neurosurgery, I don't think is affected. I have heard last year there was a female neurosurgeon interviewing in her hometown in the South. And when she asked questions about the offer, they said, "Oh, girl, don't you worry about that." Yeah. You know,
That's terrible. You know, yeah. I mean, I think that happens more often than people realize. I mean, I see different types of responses. You know, generally though, from the same institution, and I've said this before, and I sometimes, you know, people get angry at me, but from the same institution, I don't see different offers being made to my male and my female candidates. I really do not see that. I think the differences might come in picking up that extra income, you know, whether it's call related or production related. I think that's where I see the differential occur. That doesn't mean, you know, or maybe there's opportunities offered to male doctors that aren't offered to females. But my only statement is that those base offers that I see usually do start out at the same point. And there have been some anomalies for sure. I mean, sometimes my female doctors will say, well, I happen to know that my colleague, you know, who just got an offer 6 months ago from the same place was offered $20,000 more. And that to me is horrific and shocking, but I don't see that usually happening, but it could just be happening more than I see it. Do you see that at all?
Or no, I don't really see a disparity based on gender. I really don't. What I see is the disparity in respect, right? So just as wow. There was an anecdotal story of someone who was treated as if she didn't need to worry about her contract because she's, you know, some young girl, quote unquote, is, and on the other, and beyond that, I know a woman in leadership within her hospital, and the hospital administrators don't take her as seriously as, you know, her male colleagues and other specialties that are at her level.
Right. I definitely hear lots of complaints about that, or the leadership opportunities aren't coming to the women quite as often because they're afraid they're, you know, going to be too busy with their families, or they just think that whatever they say doesn't have as much weight. And obviously That whole topic is a completely different topic. But I, you know, I do think that if you want to attract candidates of all types, then your offer has to be appealing. It has to be honest. And if you are the one looking for that offer, you have to look for these kind of red flags. It can be the way they talk to you. It can be how they handle maternity leave. It can be what the opportunities for leadership or advancement are. It can be that everybody there who is a man became a partner and the women didn't. There's lots of different things. And I actually think, you know, that is all part of the process of evaluating a position. And, you know, it's really something that, you know, because you're so excited sometimes to get a job or get a great paying job or whatever, that is overlooked.
Right. And you know, well, this is a whole nother rabbit hole we could go down, but I will mention that the only disparity I really have seen that's inappropriate, I would say, are visa holders. Hospitals think that if someone has a visa, you know, has visa sponsorship needs, which is, you know, an amount of money they're investing, and I get that piece, but the amount that they're offering is far below any amount of money that they have to shell out in order to cover that visa. They think that those candidates are, you know, that their options are fewer, which they are, but they don't bring anything less to the table than someone without one, right?
I was not even aware of that. I think that's interesting. We just did a podcast a couple of weeks ago with an immigration lawyer, and we talked about some of the other issues that, you know, doctors on visas face. And I've seen them mistreated. I've seen them forced to take more call or to do other things because they can't take a chance that they're going to lose their visa with that employer. And I've seen them, you know, really abused in that way. And you're right, that is a whole other rabbit hole, but these things definitely relate. I think that's a great point that you're making. So many doctors here are here on visas too. So I think that's excellent to know. All right, so I think we probably have to wrap things up. Are there any final words you want to share? We have so much to talk about. You'll have to come back and we'll have to talk again. So any final thoughts?
I would love to come back. I think my final thoughts are to don't focus on any one thing. Really look at everything holistically. Please don't be so focused on compensation. Don't be so focused on location. Don't be so focused on one particular practice that you're ignoring the politics of the hospital, right? Look at everything holistically and make your decision then, because starting over is never fun.
Great advice. Well, thank you. And so Andrea Winslow from Rossmann Search, we appreciate you being here today. We hope you'll come back And thank all of you for joining us. If you want to know more about Retzel and Andrus, you can go to ralaw.com, and you can also see our other podcasts there and at the Health Law Hotspot on YouTube. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next time.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
The Retzel Health Law Hotspot is made available by the firm and its attorneys for educational purposes and to provide general information, not to provide specific legal advice. Use of the Retzel Health Law Hotspot does not create an attorney-client relationship between you and the firm or any of its attorneys. The Retzel Health Law Hotspot should not be used as a substitute for competent legal advice, and you should contact an attorney in your state about any legal needs or questions you may have.